I'm Ben Weingarten.
I'm Emily Jashinsky.
I'm Josh Hammer.
And I'm Rachel Bovard.
And this is NatCon Squad, where common good and common sense meet. NatCon Squad is produced by the Edmund Burke Foundation, the home for national conservatism. Subscribe now on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today, we'll be talking about four vital topics. The first is Google's ad revenue monopoly scheme. Second, we'll talk about the more than 100 CEOs at major companies who are planning to now serve as an extension of the legislative branch in America. Third, we'll be talking about Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson and his purportedly conservative position on child sex reassignment procedures. And last, we'll be talking about Biden's misadventures on the foreign policy stage, particularly with respect to multilateralism in the Middle East and at the UN as well. So with that, I'll turn it over to Rachel to talk about Google and big tech.
So Google, let's talk about Google. Google is facing antitrust scrutiny, I think, as everyone who pays attention to the space knows by now. They're facing a case brought by the Department of Justice and co-signed by about 50 state attorneys general. And they're also facing a second case led by the state of Texas, co-signed by, I think, 10 or 12 other state AGs at this point, focused exclusively on Google's digital ad dominance. And I think when people think about Google, they just frequently think it's a search platform. That's how we know Google best. But in fact, it's a vast empire and largely sort of funded and facilitated by Google's digital ad business. And for people who aren't aware of this, you know, Google serves up ads, you know, on its multiple platforms, but also across the internet. This digital ad empire began when Google purchased DoubleClick, which was then one of the most dominant, you know, digital ad businesses back in 2007. And what's interesting is that when they did that, they told the FTC, they said, "Hey, you know what? We will never actually commingle the data from what we're tracking people from across the web with our platform data." So the data they collect from, you know, their people, users of Gmail, YouTube, on Google's various other properties. Well, they said they promised the FTC they would not do that. And then 2016, they turned around and did it and suffered no consequence. And that really has given Google almost an unsurpassed data advantage that is literally no one can compete with it. But it part and parcel of this digital ad dominance is the fact that they've created such a huge market that they act, you know, Texas State Attorney General calls it, they are the pitcher, the batter, and the umpire in the same baseball game. Basically, they control every single aspect of how digital ads function online because they are the biggest auction, they're the biggest marketplace, they're the biggest purchaser, they're also representing clients. They are around every single part of this business. And it's a very, very opaque business. And Google keeps it that way because whenever anyone asks Google to explain it, they just pat them on the head and they say, "Well, it's too detailed, it's too difficult, don't worry about it." Well, Ken Paxton, the Attorney General of Texas, went after Google again, bringing an antitrust claim specific to this business model. And all of this, the details of this, you know, Google's response to this case have remained secret. Well, up until recently, when one of Google's very expensive antitrust attorneys, making about $1,500 an hour, made a basic filing error. And in filing a response to the Texas claim, forgot to redact, you know, aspects of Google's business practices as it relates to this digital ad market. And what we learned was very interesting because we learned about something that Google calls, for unknown reasons, Project Bernanke. And as part of Project Bernanke, we learned that Google was actually front-running some of these ads. So basically using the knowledge that they had as the auctioneer of past ad bids, using it to inform and in some cases change the bids their clients then offered. And they were doing this while keeping this information secret and these practices secret from other publishers that were competing in the auction. So they were essentially rigging the process. So almost like an insider trading operation that Google was doing. Now, Google claims this is completely legal. The second thing we learned from this leak was more information about a project called Jedi Blue. And again, no one knows why Google gives these projects these names. But Jedi Blue is related to a collusion deal. And that's my term for a deal between Google and Facebook in which Google is alleged to have agreed to give Facebook preferential positions in the ad market in exchange for Facebook not to compete with Google in digital advertising. Now, again, the court will ultimately decide, you know, where this falls in the range of anti-competitive behavior, but that is, you know, to the outside observer, you're approaching illegality in this marketplace when you're actually carving up the market, deciding who's going to compete or not compete, and given sort of quid pro quo in exchange. That's not allowed under our antitrust laws. So two sort of very serious issues for Google here. And again, this kind of, I often return to this idea of the over-intellectualization of antitrust. We talked about this, I think, last episode or the episode before, where, you know, we look back at the FTC's reason not to charge Google with an antitrust violation because the economists had spun this very complicated web of speculative analysis, you know, that everyone got sort of wound up into over and above actual evidence, you know, of malintent in Google's business practices. Same concept here, where Google has hired these very expensive attorneys to say, well, this is all too complicated for you. You know, you don't worry about, your eyes aren't telling you, you know, what you think they are. And I think this is something our courts are really going to have to grapple with. And I wrote about this in the New York Post because I found it somewhat, because of this fact, I found it somewhat apropos that they called it Project Bernanke, because it harkens back to the last time that we let experts sort of tell us that everything was fine, right? The very educated financial quantitative analysts told us we were all too stupid and they were very smart right before they tanked the entire economy. So I do think that, you know, Google's, the antitrust scrutiny against Google is, I think, warranted. The more we learn about what they're up to, the more we're told, oh, there's nothing to see here, the more evidence there is actually to see here. So I kind of would open it up to any comments that people have. You know, I was right before this episode, I was watching a debate that Josh did for FedSoc with Jennifer Huddleston on sort of antitrust and big tech issues. And in which she made, I think, a claim that startled me, which is that Google is not a monopoly. I think there is pretty clear evidence that they're engaging in some pretty serious anti-competitive practices. So I'll put it to the group. Do you think Google is a monopoly?
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy to jump in there. So yeah, Rachel and I were texting a little bit before the show went live about Google and their blatant monopoly status. I mean, look, I think back to an editor's note that the editors of Quillette, which is, you know, Claire Lehman's website, put out maybe 2 or 3 months ago or so. And Claire and the Quillette, you know, it's kind of part of the whole intellectual dark web crowd. I would say they're NatCon friendly, but they're definitely coming from a kind of more traditional kind of classical liberal tradition. And they signed like an editor's note basically saying that big tech are the modern robber barons. They're the modern day robber barons, and antitrust has to be used to break them up. So I look at that. I look at the fact that, was it 50 or 51, including Puerto Rico, state attorneys general are suing Google on antitrust grounds. And I mean, this has to be the most open and shut case of a monopolist since Standard Oil. I mean, like in over a century, right? I mean, it just kind of boggles the mind how Google's antitrust lawyers, as you point out, it, by the way, as a former corporate lawyer, $1,500 an hour, that's a very expensive lawyer. That is not a first year associate. So that in and of itself is telling. But look, I don't really know how much to add, honestly. I think Rachel kind of laid it out here very well. One other kind of ancillary note that I actually will add. I'm getting back from Tampa, Florida. I was in town last night for a different Feral Society event. And we're kind of talking about the political realignment and kind of shuffling constituencies and how things could possibly shape out and everything as far reaching as even like medical malpractice reform, actually. And someone asked me about plaintiff's lawyers, because traditionally, of course, you know, conservatives have always kind of hated plaintiff's lawyers. We've always kind of supported like antitrust defense. You know, I mean, I have a lot of friends from law school, for example, who, when they graduated from law school, they were right-leaning and they really wanted to be kind of antitrust defense attorneys. They wanted to represent kind of corporate interests defending against antitrust lawsuits. And what someone asked me at this dinner that I was at last night was, he said, is there a role for plaintiff's attorneys in kind of a realignment, a realigned GOP, if you will? And I think the answer is probably yes, depending on what the plaintiffs are suing, right? I mean, it's kind of like a broad brushing term, but I think back to a friend of mine, really, really smart conservative guy named Ashley Keller. He graduated UChicago Law maybe a decade before me. He's currently leading plaintiff side litigation on antitrust against Facebook. I do kind of see an opening there. So there's just so much going on right now. There's a lot of talk, obviously, about labor unions. Is there a conservative case for labor unions? Maybe there's a conservative case for some plaintiff's attorneys as well, especially vis-a-vis the big tech monopolists. But I don't have a whole lot more to add than that. I just think this is so open and shut. I mean, as Rachel said, I mean, Jennifer Huddleston, when I debated her, she's at the American Action Forum. She basically cited Bing and DuckDuckGo to try and imply that Google is not a monopoly. What market share does DuckDuckGo have? Like 0.01%? I mean, I made that number up. I don't have it in front of me,
but it's
can't
be a whole off. It can't be.
Yeah, it can't be much more than that. But Ben, Emily, maybe you disagree. I'm not sure.
Well, I was going to say that's sort of the point, right? Like in a fair competitive marketplace, DuckDuckGo, which a lot of people believe actually curates better results, and not just in a political sense, would be able to grow in a way that it hasn't in this current marketplace. And so it's sort of like the Twitter parlor argument when you're arguing that Twitter's competitor is like Facebook or something like that. I mean, this is a direct one-to-one comparison, and you kind of have your answer in the form of DuckDuckGo. It's actually not a point that's helpful from their perspective, because I think in a different place or in a different or more competitive environment, that would be, you know, a totally different question. And there are legitimate questions to be asked. Google is a behemoth. It does so many different things, and it has so many different sort of tentacles that you can't just sort of talk about Google as a whole. They're engaged in anti-competitive practices in very specific sectors of what they do. And that's the same of every tech company. So while there may be a fair marketplace in certain arenas where Google competes, in other arenas, there clearly is not. And they're engaged in practices that should be reined in. And that's sort of the point that I wanted to make. I'm at no risk of over-intellectualizing this issue because I'm not a lawyer or a policy expert here. But I will say that I don't see the broader incompatibility that I worry a lot of people who have sort of dug their heels in and are averse to maybe new concepts of where government can play a role or where government shouldn't play a role. This is not incompatible. I mean, Josh Hawley in his speech just yesterday, we're taping here on Wednesday, when they were talking about, I think it was the MLB and government monopoly action against the MLB, was talking about how these are things are not fundamentally incompatible. Like it is competition is an aspect of liberty. And that's sort of something that's it's a key ingredient in the liberty cocktail or the liberty recipe. And that's absolutely true. And so I worry that on the right, we're getting so entrenched into the sort of like TrueCon, nationalist trenches, right? So that where people are reflexively, people who are sort of like more, see themselves as more limited government types are reflexively debating or reflexively opposing the argument that Google is a monopoly and is in violation of antitrust law because it's coming from a certain sector of the right. And I don't think that's helpful. I mean, I think it's so important for us to remember that we do need to tend the capitalist garden. We do need to tend our market. We do need to weed this. And actually that is, capitalism doesn't work unless you do that. It's sort of an essential aspect of capitalism. It's a beautiful aspect of capitalism that allows for the flourishing of the market. And so I just, you know, hope that we can all at least embrace and remember that.
And just to add on to that, capitalism is under assault by corporatists working hand in hand with the government, just as our relatively liberal system is under assault by illiberal forces. And so what do you do when you're faced with those stakes? And this is sort of the eternal question that we always go back to here, which is like, this is not an even-handed, good faith competition of ideas, may the best man win sort of paradigm that we're operating in here. It's a knockdown, drag out battle for the regime. And we've clearly put our foot down on one side of it, but we need others to join us as well. And I think that's one of the purposes of trying to frame and illuminate these arguments on this show. I'll take a stab at the why is this called Project Bernanke? Maybe one is that Google is effectively the Federal Reserve of big tech, and they can print infinite gobs of money as a consequence of their dominant position based rooted in anti-competitive policies. This is also the perfect illustration of, first of all, that these corporations always end up perverting their own principles. Like Google's tagline was "Don't be evil," and look at what happens when Google gets big and powerful, and of course, power corrupting and absolute power corrupting absolutely. We see all of these telltale signs of these institutions reflecting human nature that the people who run these institutions, of course, would reject and claim doesn't exist and can be changed. Leaving all that aside, I also want to just follow up on Josh's comment about the robber barons. You know, at least the original robber barons, beyond contributing valuable goods and services, also did things, and for whatever reasons, and let's assume that they were the cynical and worst reasons, at least they helped build up cultural institutions that were sort of in line with Western civilization, like libraries and medical and research institutions and universities, and on and on. Whereas our robber barons today seek the destruction of the civilization from which they've so richly benefited, whether it's the embrace of wokeism writ large or anti-capitalist principles, or in effect aiding and abetting our worst adversaries by doing business with communist China, and on and on. And that is actually a great segue into my segment right now, which is on the fact that over 100 major corporate executives, and this included CEOs and others as well, from industries from the airlines to retailers to manufacturers and beyond, recently hopped on a web call to discuss how they could collude, again, my word, just like Rachel used collude in bringing to bear corporate power to combat states who are implementing or trying to implement voting rights, voting legislation that they don't like. And this comes on the heels, of course, of the MLB fiasco, Coca-Cola coming out against the Georgia law, and now seemingly backtracking with a mealy-mouth tweet where they talk about, or mealy-mouth messaging about how actually they want to have a listening session now, even though, of course, you know, the science is already settled and there can be no dialogue on this question, but they'll talk about a national dialogue anyway. And I think the question is this open and outright sort of collusion in terms of massive corporations getting together and saying, these are our desired legislative ends? Is this crossing a Rubicon, or is this just putting out for all to see in public what was always implicit and maybe occurred in backrooms? So I think that's one open question about what transpired here. But it also comes on the heels of something that actually Emily and I talked about in another show, a media criticism show that we do together, Bad News, where Axios, which is sort of the ruling class's smart short form newsletter, recently said that executives have to now, they need to voice their opinions on all manner of hot button political issues, as if it's an imperative to do so. I don't know who determines that it's imperative for them, but Axios seems to think that they now bear that burden. So we're going to see corporations, of course, jumping in on all manner of issues that have nothing to do with bringing a good or service to market at the best possible price and serving their customers and staying out of these questions, because neutrality itself is now apparently bigoted and intolerant. So, you know, there are a few kind of principles that we sort of continually go back to here. One is this is concentrated corporate power working hand in hand, essentially, as I argued in another episode, as an adjunct of the woke administrative state to push for these principles. Of course, you have the hypocrisy of it, and as Axios alluded to in this newsletter that we're talking about, the corporations are fine talking about all manner of domestic issues and repeatedly weighing in on the progressive side. But of course, when it comes to communist China, they want guidance from federal officials on what they should do, because God forbid they bite the hand that feeds them, or that they think is going to feed them, when otherwise might actually strangle them down the road. And then the other part of this is, why is it that they fall in line with woke dogma every time, when the woke dogma is something that is imbibed by or adhered to by such a small percentage of the country? I mean, we're talking about a small fraction, a fringe of Americans that believe in the Ibram X. Kendi or Robin DiAngelo view of America. And yet our corporations always speak in the dialect of the woke. So why is that? And what can be done to combat that are, I think, important questions. And I saw that Heritage Action, for example, has come out sort of against this woke capital sort of view with respect to voting rights legislation. But the fact that you can name that one example, and that's framed as like a shining victory on our side, I think speaks to how far behind we are in this competition, in a war that's being waged over how corporate power is used and where it is used with respect to things that should have nothing to do with corporations. So I guess the couple questions that I would open up to the group are, one, what do we make of businesses being loud and proud in acting collusively toward these political ends, and those ends always trending in one direction? And then two, how do we combat this besides kind of going after the corporatist privileges, as we've spoken about, to which many of these corporations have been privy and taken advantage of for far too long? So with that, I'll open it up to the group on those couple questions and beyond.
Yeah, I want to jump in right away, because I actually was just having a conversation when I was taping an episode of Federalist Radio Hour where the guest brought up something that gets to, I think, the most important question that Ben raised, which is why are these corporations who are typically responsive to market forces being responsive to what seems like a fringe of their consumer base? And the guest that I was talking to said, listen, we actually have to start thinking about the fact that this might be more widespread. This sort of like woke mentality might be more widespread than we realize, and corporations think they're acting in their own interest. And I thought that was kind of an interesting question, but at the same time, I actually don't think these corporations are responsive to consumers anymore. I think that in so many cases, they've been bullied by millennial employees who have come from our academies into being responsive to them over anybody else. And what we've seen a lot of reporting since these examples from Georgia, the MLB and Coca-Cola have emerged, is that this is really coming from these staff members who are pressuring the executives and people in leadership to respond to them. And again, there's another important component of this, which doesn't get discussed often enough in the aspect or in this conversation, which is that we are splintering into cultural niches. And that's a really, really important sort of part of the market forces here to understand. The reason that Stephen Colbert is able to be fully woke and also be the most popular host on late night television is that the economy is such that our media in Hollywood, streaming, everything is completely splintered. And so you increasingly, you know, you can be Nike, but there are 5 billion other options for people to shop. And so you can increasingly be responsive only to these slices of the population and be really, really successful because your market share is lower to begin with. And that's not true of every corporation, but that is increasingly true when we're looking at why certain corporations seem to be serving smaller and smaller portions of their consumer base. It's because they actually literally can do that. And the more you corner a niche and the more that Stephen Colbert gets resistance boomers to say, I cannot miss an episode of Colbert, the higher his ratings are. And that means going woker than woke. It's not Johnny Carson anymore. And that's a better analogy that you can sort of spread across a lot of sectors of our economy. And it's why, you know, we don't have mass media in the same way we used to. Thus, we don't have unifying media. We don't have unifying corporate culture in the same way that we used to. And we're sort of adapting to it. We haven't adapted well to it. So I really think, yes, on the one hand, Robin DiAngelo and Ibram X. Kendi were best-selling authors over the course of 2020. Those books rocketed to the top of the charts. They have been mainstreamed. They're more mainstream than I think some people realize. But yeah, at the same time, those are fringe, radical views. It's true they've been mainstreamed, but if you look at public polling, if you just go out anywhere into, you know, regular America that's not the Beltway or Manhattan, you talk to normal people and you realize those are still really divisive and radical ideas. So why? I mean, I think the sort of splintering of our economy has a lot to do with it.
Just really briefly, I'm going to put forward my thesis here, and it's largely in line with what Emily said, which is that in the absence of any competing force to the social justice shakedown artists that exist out there, the corporatists will always cave to the social justice shakedown artists. And I'd suggest that there are a few reasons potentially for it, and it varies by company and cohort. And the first is that there are the true believers who actually agree with woke ideology. They come from the same commanding heights as the woke, and they've actually drank the Kool-Aid. There's a second group of people who are the cowards who fear the woke mob and thus will always fall in line, and also potentially the politicians as well who are in line with the woke mob. And then lastly, there are the cynics who think that you can feed the cultural Marxist crocodile by essentially paying for absolution from your putatively capitalist sins, expecting that you won't get eaten by that crocodile, foolishly so. That's what I would suggest the paradigm is in terms of the three potential reasons why they always go along with the fringe.
That paradigm makes a lot of sense to me. If I could just kind of add one idea, I'll go full University of Chicago just for a brief second here. In the economic literature, some economist whose name I'm blanking on, so it's been a handful of years since I took the course, won a Nobel Prize for public choice theory. And public choice theory was kind of centered around George Mason University and now the Mercatus Center. And one of the great teachings of public choice theory is that public policy is too often dictated by a very narrow subset of the population that has a serious, serious, serious vested interest in an outcome. And by exclusion, what is ignored is a much broader swath, a much broader subset of the populace that has a more discrete interest at stake. The example that kind of free traders, public choice theorists would use is basically saying that, you know, kind of, let's say the steel industry wants to kind of get a tariff for various reasons. All the consumers will, you know, be hurt in lower prices, whatever. Just one example. So I think from a public choice perspective, it's kind of easy to see what's going on here, right? From like the woke mob, the Ibram S. Kendis of the world, they are loud. They are loud and they are proud, and they are not afraid to call anyone who disagrees with them a racist, sexist, bigot, homophobe, transphobe, xenophobe, whatever. No one likes getting called names. Now, at the same time, though, that interest in not getting called a racist is, I think, necessarily a little more ethereal, a little less directly connected to this self-inflated kind of pompous interest that the woke mob, the anti-racist cartel has in dictating the norms of our public debate, because they have elevated themselves to being the gatekeepers of what is and what is not acceptable. And that therefore under public choice theory gives them a very kind of narrow, tight concentric interest. So I just think that's just an alternative way to kind of view the framework here. But I obviously endorse basically everything that Ben and Emily said as well.
Yeah, I think two quick points on, you know, what I think Emily very artfully laid out what is happening. And I think the first element is that wokeism has escaped the universities, right? Like, I do think it's absolutely correct. I see this in, you know, I observe big tech very closely. You know, it's not necessarily the CEOs themselves who are so, you know, hyped up about, you know, being anti-conservative. They're responding very quickly to this woke middle management who is demanding things of them, you know, in very hostile and very public ways. And, you know, you've seen now no company wants the coverage of their employees walking out, you know, and like protesting them and quitting en masse, which, you know, honestly would probably be good for some of these companies, to be totally honest. But but I do think that they're the monster is, it's like, the what do they say, the phone's ringing from inside the room. Like that's what's happening in a lot of these companies. The phone is ringing inside the room. But I think the second point you made, Emily, which I think is very apt, is that in so many areas of the culture, our politics, you know, all of these things, we don't have an agreement anymore on generally how we will live together or what we should prioritize. And our media definitely, or I'm sorry, our media reflects this, but so does our sort of consumer experience. And it goes back to this idea, you know, that Michael Jordan had. And if anybody watched, was it The Last Dance during quarantine? It was on ESPN, now streaming on Netflix. I've watched it like three times because it just makes me nostalgic for the 90s, I think. But, you know, there's an episode where they talk about Michael Jordan confronting this at first, right? Where he wasn't, you know, an outspoken about civil rights, and he should have been more outspoken about, you know, Black issues. And he was, you know, selling these shoes and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, he said, well, Republicans buy sneakers too, right? And that was really the prevailing attitude of business. And that profit motive, right, to reach the biggest audience possible, that we as conservatives, we always assumed that would protect us to some extent, it was like a market enforced neutrality because, you know, it would serve the dollar, basically. That is not the case anymore. That is just not the case anymore. And I always come back to the way Ben Domenech framed it when he said, Republicans buy sneakers too, but should they? That is now the calculus that business has toward any ideology with which they disagree. And our politics need to now respond to that. And I think that's the challenge for a Republican Party that has been so reflexively aligned with business and made so many assumptions about how they will behave based on the profit motive that we're almost caught, well, we are caught completely flat-footed when that has not turned out to be the case anymore. So we may come back around to that, I think, toward the end, but I'll just leave it at that.
Well, there's a way to have that bridge into our next segment, actually, which is about the legislation that Governor Asa Hutchinson of Arkansas, Republican Governor Asa Hutchinson of Arkansas, vetoed this last week, which I think actually offers a cleaner and more instructive case study or contrast between where people think government, what people think conservatism should be in terms of the scope of government. A cleaner contrast and a cleaner, more instructive case study than what we saw in South Dakota, frankly, because Asa Hutchinson came out outright and said that his decision to veto the legislation, which would have outlawed puberty blockers and surgeries to treat gender dysphoria, and in fact it will because his veto was overridden by the legislature. He vetoed that on the grounds that it's on the grounds of limited government, that it was not the proper role of government to ban such treatments for gender dysphoria. There are some people who believe that in limited cases, it's acceptable. It's just some reasonable people, I would say, who believe in limited cases that it's acceptable to treat children this way. I think that is wildly unreasonable. There are, of course, the entire left believes that it is a necessity, that this is a necessary medical treatment. But this is really something from a Republican governor, but a Democratic governor, you know, 10 years ago that would have been completely unthinkable. This, we have limits on medical treatment. We have laws that bar harmful medical treatment. We have laws that ban the prescription, the wrongful prescription of certain drugs. We have all of these laws to rein in harmful medical treatment. It is hardly a breach of a limited government philosophy to ask the government to basically protect children from an ideology that has run amok in the medical profession, when doctors are too afraid to say that it's dangerous, when they're too afraid to take part in studies that say that it's dangerous, when we so obviously know that children's brains are not fully developed and that they cannot make informed decisions that will cause, as Abigail Schreier sort of at this point has iconically dubbed, irreversible damage to their bodies before they have fully developed brains, before they have fully developed concepts of sex and gender. To say that that is not the role of a limited government seems completely outrageous. And I really do think it would have been unthinkable 10 years ago from a Republican governor, let alone a Democratic governor. And that's not because we've made so much progress in equality in this country. It's because the pendulum has swung so far in the opposite direction that, as we were just talking about in the last segment, everybody who has, who disagrees, think of someone like Paul McHugh, who is a doctor who works on these issues, who was ostracized from his profession after he started to disagree on the excesses of transgenderism. Who else would want to follow in his footsteps and be the canary in the coal mine? Who else wants to say we need to slow down when they see what's happened to the other people? And that's why we have the ideology run amok in the medical profession, and that's why children need to be protected, and that's why conservatives who believe in protecting children and who believe in a government that does the basics that we pay it with our taxpayer dollars to do, like protecting children, should believe in. And there was an interesting debate in the pages of National Review and in commentary from people who believed on one side or the other. But I mean, it just seems to me that this would not have been a matter of debate in a more rational world. It just seems like such a basic role of the government to protect children, and it seems like such a basic, obvious fact that these surgeries can be enormously harmful, let alone what we don't know about them. And so with that, I'll open it up to my co-panelists here. What does this say about our definition of conservatism?
Well, Emily, I think you left out the most important part, which is that in his defense, Asa Hutchinson summoned Ronald Reagan.
Yes.
And no less than William F. Buckley.
William F. Buckley.
Like, in a very deeply uncomfortable interview to watch, actually, with Tucker Carlson, where he was defending himself, I actually had secondhand anxiety. I was like sweating for him because it was just so brutal. But like, I was so offended at that moment where he summons Reagan and Buckley and you know, the work that they've done is somehow justifying, you know, not putting the government in between, you know, parents deciding to chemically castrate their children, again, based on this completely baseless ideology. And to me, this just showed how intellectually hollow some elements of establishment conservatism have become, where we just repeat, we, you know, spew these empty sort of just, you know, axiom or just statements about Reagan and Buckley, and they have no meaning anymore. We use them to justify things that are fundamentally unconservative. And it frustrates me because as a limited government conservative, right, I do believe that the government has limits. But I think the way he used it here flips the whole consensus on its head, because we say, right, through our limited government, we decide what kind of society we want. We take actions to preserve and protect our culture and our social consensus. What he's suggesting is the exact opposite of that. What he's suggesting is to allow this sort of medical tyranny based on, you know, not even medically dubious, but just literally allowing children to do irreparable harm and to, again, Abigail Schreier's sort of a iconic statement, irreversible damage to themselves. Tucker, I think, made this point clear when he was like, we have these laws all the time. Do we allow children to drink? Should we allow a 12-year-old to go pop a beer? Or, you know what I mean? We don't allow parents, as conservatives, we stand up and say we shouldn't allow parents to take their minor children across state lines to seek an abortion. You know, we have these elements and these parameters set in public law. This is the essence of conservatism, is to conserve and protect the traditions that have made us a great country. And so I do think it speaks volumes that he would summon Reagan and Buckley as somehow that gives him a get out of jail free card. I'm hopeful that as a movement, we are smarter than that. But you know, it's been 30 years in the making, so who knows?
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know where to start on this. I have so many thoughts, honestly. So look, let's go back to first principles here. Let's do like a very brief constitutional law tutorial. James Madison in Federalist number 45 says that the powers delegated to the federal government are few and far between. The powers reserved in the states are, quote, indefinite. That's obviously kind of what the 10th Amendment is getting at. In an 1887 Supreme Court case called Mugler versus Kansas, for the law nerds out there, the Supreme Court more or less affirmed this. The fact pattern there dealt with alcohol restrictions on sales in the state of Kansas. And the court basically said that the so-called police powers of the state, and kind of the Madisonian framework, the police powers that are reserved to the states have plenary power to regulate the health, morals, and safety of the citizenry. What issue could possibly more directly implicate the health, morals, and the safety of the citizenry than chemical castration and puberty-blocking hormones for easily duped, misled teenage girls? Rachel's right. That interview with Asa Hutchinson was a national disgrace. I do think it bespeaks a lot of kind of the intellectual rot and the sclerosis that has kind of happened over the decades. A lot of how conservatives have failed to rethink orthodoxies. The fact that kind of limited government and free markets can possibly get brought up in this context is just absolutely asinine. And look, we all believe in free markets on this show, okay? Whether we believe the free markets are a means to other substantive ends or an end unto itself, you know, we've discussed this in previous podcasts. I think that can continue to be debated, but we all believe in free markets. That does not mean that the government has no role to play whatsoever in protecting vulnerable citizens, in fostering public virtue, in parents' rights, in preserving the integrity of the Hippocratic Oath. How about that one, going back 2,500 years? Is there an argument, by the way, that chemical castration does not violate the Hippocratic Oath to do no harm? If there is, I'm not aware of it. This debate has just gotten so out of hand in so many ways. The transgender debate now, focusing on the actual underlying substance here. I mean, Abigail Schreier's name was mentioned. She's a friend. I published her many times in Newsweek. But people like Abigail are so few and far between. And these are kind of the courageous people that we need to go out of our way to encourage. And to have kind of a Republican governor, by the way, in a deep red state, Arkansas, obviously an old kind of Southern state. The state legislature didn't flip to Republican until the past 10, 15 years. But at this point, it's a very, very, very solidly red state. So to have the Republican governor of a red state like that just throw all of this, throw the Abigail Schreiers of the world, the Ryan Andersons of the world, obviously throw the legacy of people like Reagan and Buckley under the bus here. It just bespeaks such a degree of intellectual rot that you really just have to do sit there and kind of shake your head and say, what on earth is this? We're running out of time, so I don't want to take too much longer, but the final point I'll make here, there was an interesting kind of Twitter debate that I found myself into, another kind of interconservative debate that kind of spawned off of this terrible Tucker Carlson, Asa Hutchinson interview, was whether or not kind of just the rhetoric of states' rights too often leads to just doing nothing, right? So I kind of saw Patrick Deneen, the Notre Dame political science professor, basically saying that social conservatives have been duped. They've been duped by the language of states' rights. That is kind of another argument to kind of use the power of the federal government more in kind of a Sohrab Ahmari-esque kind of way. Don't have time this segment to fully unpack that, just kind of flagging that that's yet another kind of ancillary debate from this whole sordid affair.
I don't think I have a lot to add in terms of the substance of this argument. I also thought it was just laughable, the invocation of Reagan and Buckley, when it should have been like Michel Foucault or name your other kind of postmodernist radical that should have been invoked. Maybe Asa Hutchinson wasn't able to find out about Ryan Anderson's book because of Amazon's censorship of it. It's inexplicable to me that he could come to the conclusion that he did, except for the fact that this once again shows that the powers that be in this country continually fall in line with the woke fringe of a minority here. And the left, to its credit, even though they're materialists, they always argue from the perspective of justice and morality and right and wrong, even though they're more relativists and the like. And as Claremont Institute always says, we need to make arguments from justice as well. And this is a perfect example of how unmoored we are from making arguments or thinking about these questions in terms of justice and natural law and really just human nature more broadly. And of course, it's the party of science, the Democrats, who are on the side of, as we've talked about, chemical castration and what in effect amounts to, for all too many people, based upon the research that's out there and based on Ryan's writings and research and others, in effect ends up cruel and unusual punishment with catastrophic consequences for these individuals and their families in many cases that they can never recover from. So it's a tragedy, and it is in effect a government-induced tragedy, I would argue, again, as a consequence of cowardice in the face of a mob that essentially argues that you're bigoted if you disagree with the statement. And that was not what Governor Hutchinson said in that interview. He didn't say he was caving to the woke mob. He said, basically, this is a hands-off question. But it's not a hands-off question when it comes to the health and well-being of your citizens, and in particular, children who are not equipped to come to these decisions. So with that, I'll turn it over for the fourth segment.
Yeah. So, you know, we try to cover foreign policy a little bit on this podcast, sometimes more than a little bit. And we're recording this on Wednesday. And earlier today, Joe Biden's ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas Greenfield, just had an appalling interview where she's talking about whether the United Nations Human Rights Council. The UN Human Rights Council, by the way, Trump withdrew from the Human Rights Council. Just so everyone's aware, we have a very informed audience. They probably know all this already. The UN Human Rights Council, despite its kind of lofty, nice-sounding name, is one of the most morally bankrupt transnational institutions in the world. The only permanent item on their agenda is kind of an Israel bashing session where they reaffirm that Israel is an illicit occupier in Judea and Samaria, which is incorrect as a matter of international law. They condemn Israel more than the rest of the world combined routinely. And Trump withdrew from that. But today, Linda Thomas Greenfield, Biden's UN ambassador, talking about whether the U.S. should consider rejoining the UN Human Rights Council, she says, quote, "If we do so, we must acknowledge our failures." And here's the marquee quote: "White supremacy is weaved into our founding documents and principles." How far removed can we possibly be from the era of the great Jean Kirkpatrick, talking about joining the jackals of the United Nations? How far removed can we possibly be from Daniel Patrick Moynihan, talking about how the U.S., the United States of America, will never recognize the infamous U.N. resolution pertaining to Zionism being racism? And this, of course, is coming on the heels of the Biden administration restoring $235 million in funding to the Palestinian Authority and UNRWA, that's the U.N. Relief and Works Agency. UNRWA is the agency that is effectively dedicated to the Palestinian issue. They operate in both Jan Samaria and Gaza. UNRWA is actually in contrast to a distinct UN agency called the United Nations High Commissioner on Refugees. A fun fact, by the way, the UN High Commissioner on Refugees and UNRWA have different definitions of who is actually a refugee. The UN High Commissioner on Refugees has the well-accepted international law definition of refugee, which is if you were actually born in the country and then something happens to you, you can be a refugee. UNRWA, by contrast, says that if you are a descendant of someone who lived in the land of Israel and what was then called Palestine from 1946, 1940, if you are a mere descendant, then you are a refugee. So, you know, we don't have time to unpack everything here. Many scholars and commentators have spoken about how UNRWA is a problem in and of itself, therefore, because they are actually perpetuating the conflict. They are not helping Palestinians resettle elsewhere. UNRWA itself, of course, is involved with anti-Semitic indoctrination in Gaza. They are in bed with Hamas as far as the schools that they run there. In the last full-scale Israel-Hamas war in 2014, UNRWA provided shelter for Hamas to fire rockets into Israel. And there's another issue here, too. There's just so much going on here. There's a lot to unpack in one segment. But, of course, there's a matter of statutory law. There's a Taylor Force Act, which was signed into law in 2018. The Trump administration signed this into law. It was named after Taylor Force, who was murdered by a Palestinian jihadist in March 2016. I remember it extremely well because it was less than a week before I myself flew to Israel from Chicago. So I remember reading all about it at the time, actually. And the Taylor Force Act, passing law, basically says that the U.S. taxpayer will not subsidize the Palestinian Authority unless and until their pay-to-slay program, by which the Palestinian Authority subsidizes the families of jihadists, ends. They haven't done so, and yet we're restoring aid to them. So there's another legal debate here, but let's not miss the forest for the trees here. The broader point, and this is kind of where I'm going to open up to the panel, the broader point here, of course, is about the role of the United Nations in U.S. foreign policy in general. The kind of the broader point is about transnationalism versus unilateralism. Do these transnational institutions play any role whatsoever? Is the Biden administration kind of the Democratic Party's notion that by getting involved in these corrupt institutions like the UN, like UNRWA, like UNESCO, like all the various other jackal overrun institutions, the Biden administration says that by getting involved, we can reform them from within? I think that's hopelessly naive. I would assume the panel agrees with me, but I'm curious to hear nonetheless.
How can we reform them from within when we need to be reformed from within? When the people we are sending to those positions to allegedly reform institutions like the UN don't fundamentally believe or share the values that they could then import into those institutions that would help reform them. This was as good an illustration as ever of that. That the person that we are literally sending as our representative, who should be proud of our history and what we've overcome, right? This is seeing the glass half empty when it is clearly half full in the scope of human history. We so easily lose sight of what a magnificent society the United States of America in the year 2021 is. It is incredible the cultures that have the old melting pot analogy, which feels old hat now, is completely true, and we live it out every single day in this country, in communities across the country that are peaceful and happy and prosperous and brought together people from all different cultures, from all parts of the world, in a way that has never happened in human history. And to send our representative into the United Nations in a way that she cannot proudly proclaim that and is apologizing for us instead of going in there and actually serving as a model and an example for what the rest of the world too can overcome, for what the rest of the world should hold true as their values, because we've run that experiment and we've done it more successfully than any of those other countries. In fact, any country in the history of the world is absolutely disgusting, and it shows the consequences that the intellectual rot of our elite class will have in the long term. This is serious. It's alarming. It is not just an off-the-cuff abstraction from a social justice warrior put in a throwaway post. This is a representative to the United Nations speaking in, I think, a very consequential capacity. What a joke, what an embarrassment, and what a statement on how far we have come from what we should believe, what the reality is about this country. I mean, it's just hard to watch.
Yeah, I just want to add some context to what the ambassador's comments were about, because again, this is the Human Rights Council, okay? And she's standing there apologizing for America, you know, one of basically the freest country the world has ever seen. She's apologizing for America to the countries that sit on the Human Rights Council, which include three countries, Sudan, Somalia, and Pakistan, which punish homosexuality with death. That is who she is apologizing to for the United States of America. It could not be more craven. It could not be more disgusting, I think, to Emily's point. And this is supposed to be our representative to the United Nations. And, you know, when I saw this earlier, I put a quote from Daniel Patrick Moynihan on Twitter, because it really, I've just been thinking a lot about it recently, where he himself, former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, and he said, "Am I embarrassed to defend an imperfect democracy? No, I am not, because find me its equal." That is the attitude with which we should be approaching these absolute clowns at the United Nations. You know, instead of this moral equivalency where, you know, we reflect on our imperfect history of slavery, which, you know, we have grappled with substantially, and I would suggest put in the most free rule of law the world has ever seen, and we compare, we apologize for that, and we get on our knees in the front of countries who, again, stone people for being gay. I mean, there is just no comparison whatsoever. And the last thing I will say about this, I think Emily's absolutely right about the intellectual rot that is coming for the elite, but 78 United States senators voted to confirm this woman. So that's every Democrat, and presumably every Democrat and about 30 Republicans. And so there's something amiss, much more than just at the United Nations.
So right at the top, I think it's worth noting that Ambassador Thomas Greenfield gave a speech in front of a Confucius Institute, a paid speech at, I believe it was Savannah State University, where she spoke favorably about the Chinese Communist Party. And I think that's no accident here when you see her speaking in the exact same narratives that two of the top Chinese Communist Party diplomats leveled at American officials recently at that meeting in Anchorage, Alaska, which we covered here, talking about how America has a history of human rights violations. This coming from a Chinese Communist Party that was responsible for the deaths, if not outright murders, of tens of millions of their own citizens. And the other members of the Human Anti-Rights Council, of course, follow a similar trajectory in terms of their tyranny and oppression and persecution of people. And there used to be a concept that you don't badmouth America, that the criticism ends at water's edge. I mean, you shouldn't badmouth America anyway, but you especially don't do it in international forums or overseas. So this is demoralizing to America. It signals to the world weakness and a lack of moral clarity, which pervades this entire administration, I would argue. And an even more basic point, and this goes to all of the progressives, it's not just Linda Thomas Greenfield, but it's all of them, is how could any of these people be counted on to defend America if they think it's an irredeemable and deplorable bastion of bigotry? The logic goes that if that's what you think our country is, then you need to turn all of our values and principles and institutions on their heads. And I think in a nutshell, that's what progressivism ultimately aims at least if you follow the theory to the end. Beyond that, I would just say, with respect to the UN in general, this is the perfect example of the disaster of globalism when we cede our sovereignty to an institution like this, at least under Democrat presidents and probably arguably under some Republicans as well. But we pay the vast majority of the dollars, at least a plurality of the dollars, to the UN. And of course, the UN is on American soil as well. And what is the UN used for? It aids, abets, and enables, and of course, legitimizes the worst regimes on earth. So are the American taxpayers, I mean, just from a crude perspective, are they really getting bang for their buck by contributing hundreds of millions of dollars every year to an organization that hates their guts, essentially? It just makes no sense. It's illogical. It's irrational. The best argument that you can make is better to be inside this horrible organization and try to reform it than outside it. But by being inside it, you're merely legitimizing your worst adversary. So I'm not sure that argument really holds water. And then lastly, on the merits, where Josh started with respect to UNRWA and beyond, and the administration essentially resubsidizing pay to slay policy and the like. It's interesting that this is also happening at a time when the administration's bending over backwards to try to get back into a new, supposedly longer and stronger Iran deal. This is on the heels of a Yom HaShoah message where the administration was, I guess, commemorating the Holocaust and speaking in solidarity and saying never again. While at the same time, they are again aiding, abetting, and enabling the world's modern day Nazis in effectively Hamas, their allies, and of course, a genocidal jihadist Iranian regime that's the world's leading state sponsor of jihad and of course targets Israel for annihilation. So you have all that going on at once. And I just say, what more could our adversaries ask for than an administration that takes this sort of line and posture and then has the policies to back it up as well? Who benefits? Our worst adversaries.
Yeah, what's the famous Star Wars line? It's about like a wretched hive of scum and villainy. I used to call the United Nations that in my writings all the time. I probably should bring that back. Just one final point before we go to final thoughts here, because I meant to mention this in my kind of opening remarks and just totally forgot to do so. I had a long essay at Tablet Magazine last month and kind of the peace process that never was between the Israelis and the Palestinians, how the Palestinian Authority has never wanted peace, going back to very public, open, right out there in the open quotes from Yasser Arafat and the Palestinian Authority in the 1970s. It's important to emphasize here just how quickly the Biden administration appears to be throwing under the bus and totally making a 180-degree turn on the transformative paradigm shift, that Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu did with respect to the Israeli-Palestinian issue. For 4 years, Donald Trump and Netanyahu at his side showed time and time again that the way to kind of make peace for rapprochement between Israel and the Arab world is not to mollycoddle the Palestinians. On the contrary, it is to stand defiantly with Israel, to stand against the mutual enemy of the theocratic Shiite zealots in Tehran. And due to that, by the United States not kind of caving to these Islamist actors, by standing by our allies, you will help the region come together. That ultimately, of course, led to the Abraham Accords. And, you know, sure enough, we're a few months into the Biden administration. They're throwing all that into the bus. They're going to reopen the PLO mission in Washington, D.C. They're funding the Palestinian Authority. And it's the same old playbook. Apparently, Judea and Samaria are now referred to as occupied territories again on the State Department website. Everything that's old and terrible is new again. So just awful. I wish I could be more optimistic about that, but it's very hard to do so. But maybe one of you has a more optimistic final thoughts. Let's take it around the horn here. Anyone have a slightly more optimistic take than that?
I could start. You know, I think in thinking about, and even just this last segment about the comments that were made, you know, about sort of apologizing for America, it reminds me of the RNC convention. I think it was this last summer, one of the most compelling speeches made by a Cuban immigrant, or I think it was a Cuban immigrant whose name escapes me at the moment, but he spoke almost in tears when he said, recalling his father saying, "We're going to America, there is no other place to go." And that I think remains true. You know, America remains, I think, the freest sort of beacon of hope that this world has. And as conservatives, our mission has always been to protect that which makes it possible. You know, Russell Kirk called it the permanent things, to make sure the permanent things are in the saddle. And I think all of the things that we talked about today, you know, conservatives have to be ready to act, you know, through state government, through federal government, to protect, you know, those when those elements are threatened, whether it's from the culture, you know, whether it's, you know, encroachment on, again, the sanctity of personhood as a child, you know, whether it's our market being threatened by monopolists, whether it's, you know, our sovereignty being sort of pushed around overseas. These are all aspects that conservatism is equipped to handle. It is, again, to protect and conserve the traditions, the permanent things, to make America and keep America sort of the greatest, freest, you know, beacon of liberty that the world has seen. So to tie them all together, that's sort of where I'll leave it.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just kind of quickly add to my previous comments and make this my official final thoughts, if you will. One thing that kind of stands out here is just the galling hypocrisy of our kind of political adversaries on the left, whether it is Linda Thomas Greenfield, you know, as Rachel said, pointing out Somalia and all these countries stoning homosexuals to death. But no, America 1619 Project, we are the ones who are bigoted to our core. So whether it's the Biden administration's political actors, or of course, whether it's the woke corporations, whether it's companies like Disney, where there's companies that are boycotting Georgia over a very kind of milquetoast, anodyne election reform law, are simultaneously doing business, of course, in China, where now administrations of both parties have said is literally committing genocide, like as the actual term genocide is defined under Geneva. So the hypocrisy here, whether it's kind of from a political perspective or a corporate perspective, is just galling. And this kind of reminds me of something that we talked about on and on and on in this show, is kind of the follies, I think, of kind of the most hardcore form of kind of liberal proceduralist from our side. Because the entire kind of premise of liberal proceduralism is taking as a on faith that we have something in common, that we're at least operating in decent good faith with one another. With each passing day, with each news cycle, it just, I think, is increasingly more obvious to me that our adversaries on the left, again, whether it's kind of from a political or woke capital perspective, are just not operating in good faith. The hypocrisy here on our segments today is just absolutely galling.
I'll jump in and say, you know, I'm thinking about why a Republican governor like Asa Hutchinson, who has always just been sort of considered a mainstream conservative guy, whether or not that's true, that's sort of the perception of him, would veto a piece of legislation like this, even without some of the corporate pressure or the level of corporate pressure that we saw applied to, say, Kristi Noem in her girls' sports bill. When I think about it, it's because there is genuinely, you know, the left has this very persuadable framing, and they are able to say, listen, you know, they're able to bring their most reasonable people forward and say, there are some children who have benefited from this. You know, there are a few of them. And if you outlaw this, you are hurting children. And they come with that persuasive argument, and it works. But I think it does work increasingly less because there are the people like Abigail Schreier in the world. There are the people, like, silly as it sounds, J.K. Rowling. There are more and more people people for whom the democratization and the nichification and the splintering of our media economy is really empowering and emboldening to find landing pads outside of the traditional corporate media structure that has shut them out and silenced them in the name of protecting children, laughably in the name of protecting children. Laugh or cry, but you know they're creating this new infrastructure that's really working for somebody like Abigail Schreier, and that's really I think something that can be optimistic if we think about why Asa Hutchinson would veto a piece of legislation like this that would 10 years ago have been so obvious. I mean, it's just such an obvious reality. I think we have voices that are being empowered to build this new infrastructure that in the future will get a message to Asa Hutchinson that he cannot deny, and that will be so clear, and that will bring moral clarity back to our conversation in a powerful way. So to the extent that there's something optimistic to find in all of this, I do see the Abigail Schreiers of the world as a very, very good, a very good case study and an uplifting one.
And I think it's important to hold up courageous figures because they can help inspire others and have an impact that goes well beyond their individual achievements and initiatives. On the other hand, I agree with Josh, and I continue to find myself coming to a similar conclusion, which is that we're operating in a world of bad faith. And so what do you do when presented with a situation where there's not even the thin veneer of an even-handed debate where the best argument wins and we all kind of agree on certain core values and principles, but we just differ in how we think they should be applied and what's the best way to get to the outcomes that we all share. That's obviously not the world that we're living in. On the other hand, we know this now because the ruling class's rot and corruption has never been exposed more sort of openly and honestly than it's been exposed today. And maybe it's always been like this, but I don't think that's the case. I think there's been a devolution and a corruption that's transpired over many decades, and we're seeing kind of the worst fruits of it today, and it's occurring at an accelerating pace as well. But the fact that it is open is a good thing. It allows us to study it and think about ways of combating it. And so my sort of silver lining to end on today is that we're operating in an incredibly target-rich environment. I mean, notwithstanding that there is a war on wrongthink underway, real or literal or at a minimum figurative, that we may all end up gulagged and maybe you won't be able to view these videos in 6 months. Nevertheless, setting all of that aside, there's still tens of millions of Americans yearning for a message that is an alternative to the ruling class's progressive orthodoxy or the woke dogma. And beyond that, because we have failed to compete in so many different areas, there are so many wide open fields where even just the attempt to compete could lead to massive changes on a relative basis, at least major shifts, even just, for example, figuring out a way to put something akin to the pressure on corporations that the left is putting on them to get them to back off of us and stop serving as an adjunct of, in effect, the woke administrative state. You can think of an infinite amount of initiatives that we ought to be undertaking in every sort of effort with respect to the sort of whole of society onslaught that we're withering under and under attack from right now, but we can compete in all of these areas. We haven't even started to compete in all these areas. I don't even think we've grappled with how comprehensive the assault is. And so our project ought to be, in my view, to identify what are the most fertile areas of competition, what are the most important areas where we need to compete, and then what is the most efficacious and strategic way to go about in competing in them. And I think that's something that we'll hash out over time on this show. But again, I think the fact that it's a target-rich environment, it's a shame that there are so many targets on the one hand. But on the other hand, it means there's great opportunity and we can make tremendous strides at a minimum on a relative basis. And that's a positive that I would walk away with. So on that relatively sunny note, on behalf of Josh, Emily, and Rachel, thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Ben Weingarten. We'll see you at the next NatCon Squad.